And now, Liz and or Ryan or whoever, how are you doing it? We'll share our scripture with us.
So this is from John chapter 20, verse 19 through 31. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven."
Now Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
Thank you, and Reggie, thank you so much for being with us today. We look forward to hearing from you.
I was raised in a religion built on miracles, the veracity of visions, and the existence of archangels. We acknowledged the resurrection, of course, but we also believed in the reality of visitations, such as when the young French girl Bernadette saw the Blessed Virgin Mary hovering in the air at a grotto in Lourdes, France. The Virgin told Bernadette to dig in order to find water. She did, and she did, and Bernadette became a saint. Joan of Arc received visions of the Archangel Michael, St. Margaret, and St. Catherine of Alexandria, telling her to go into battle in order to free France from England. It didn't work out so good for her. Angels were silently suspended in the air while they bore witness to the three wise men as they beheld the Messiah for the first time. And wasn't it the Archangel Gabriel who said to Mary, "Hail, thou that art highly favored, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst all women." I was told it was the Archangel Michael who would lovingly carry the souls of the dead to heaven. A cornerstone of Catholicism is the belief in visions and miracles and the sacred reality of the invisible. My experience in the church was of a religion built on ritualized mysticism and the belief that the unseen is visible to those of pure heart and mind. Back then, my relationship to God was something that happened in a place called church, a building made by humans for the glory of God. I liked going to church. I loved the kneeling and the getting up, the bells, the crossing three times, the incense and candles and the unintelligible chanting of the Monsignor and all those mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. All of that was beautiful to me, and I sensed an unmistakable spiritual presence there. But it wasn't until I left the church and went out into the world that I saw the invisible spirit of life and death spoken about in church. The invisible became visible to me at the St. Lawrence River. And that's where I experienced God's eternal presence. I was born by a river. The St. Lawrence River was magical, magnificent, and immeasurable. Its seasons are reliable but unpredictable, like mothers and God and grab bag candy. The plows make snow tires over 10 feet tall at Mercer's Beach. And neighborhood kids take turns throwing each other down the side just for the right to yell, "I'm king of the mountain." All the kids take turns being king and prince. Mary and Cindy go to skating parties at the rink by the baseball field. They warm up next to the hot pot-bellied stoves constantly fueled with wood by Mr. Ferguson. And Jack Frost leaves swirling ice pictures on the window of my unheated bedroom every morning. You know, it's not your eyes that tell you how cold it is outside. It's your ears. The tires that crunch, that particular crunch of the really cold, cold weather as the tires went over it, that's what told us how we should get dressed up in the morning. In my town, Clayton, we are right on the St. Lawrence River, right at the mouth of the Lake Ontario and the river. So it's the widest part. It's not the deepest, it's the widest. And in the wintertime, we would have horse and buggy races. It was so cold, the farmers would bring their beautiful black horses and their carts behind them. And then they'd go in a circle all on the channel. All of us kids would be dressed up like penguins when we just sort of slide in our bellies down to the channel. And as the horses went around and around, the spray of the ice going behind them as they ran, it was so cold, their snot froze into ropes and tinkled down to the ice. Those were regular winters on the St. Lawrence River. But on the really cold winters, when it was consistently below zero, the river freezes about as thick as a man's arm is long. And on those frigid winter nights, my father taught us how to walk across the channel using the stars and a stick as our map. He's looking for some fun on Grindstone Island where Emmett Dodge lives. See, on Friday nights, Emmett takes out his fiddle, plays a tune, and calls out round dances and square dances and line dances until it's time to call it quits. See, my dad loved to dance, especially to Emmett's playing, so he gets us all bundled up. We go to Mercer's Beach. We string out like a line of fish with my father as the bobber. The sounds of snow and ice, the real thermometer in winter, not a silver line in a glass cylinder. Cold, crackling air and cracking sheets of ice tell you to go around, get off, or move forward. It's your ears, not your eyes, that save your life on a big river like ours. The cold forces us to breathe deeply through our mouths and we exhale balls of ice onto our scarves. Woolen socks warm our feet and hand-me-down patched-up boots. We stand in line, Dave, Dad, Tim, Cindy, Mary, and then me. With a long and thick stick, my pop stabs the ice in front of him until he hears a shh sound and says, "Yeah, it's frozen here. We can walk here." And then shh, 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 shh. Slowly we make our way across. We form a snake line, holding hands and spreading out so there isn't too much weight in one place. Dad's cigarette smoke hangs in the air like fingers, pointing to Grindstone Island. In those snot-freezing winters, Dad us all the way across the white channel slab, all the way to Grindstone Island. From Aunt Jane's Bay, it's a short walk up the road to the community center where we find our fun. Emmett calls out the dances and saws away on the fiddle. Everybody's out. The Meeks, the Dodges, the Guernseys, the Turcotts, the Potters. We dance and then bundle up and Pop gets us home. Springtime. Oh, most people know it's spring when the trees leaf out, the scent returns to the air, and the worms begin their expedition across roads just to see what's on the other side. And birdsong floats in through the windows. But to us, to Claytoners, those were arbitrary signs of spring. You see, Sometime during the winter, somebody drives an old jalopy out into the middle of the channel, and on the day the jalopy falls through the ice, first day of spring. Now, in the fall, the river takes off that beautiful China blue dress she wears all summer long and changes into a gray-green dress with lace and Swiss wild polka dots. She takes up smoking again, mostly in the mornings. French inhales of wispy smoke curl into the air at dawn. An international woman of mystery, the river stops speaking English and switches to her other language, French. You see, all summer long, the river says lap, lap, lap. But listen closely in the fall, and she says glip, glip, glip. But summer's the best of all. On June 24th, 3:15 p.m., last school bell of the school of the year rings, and my sister Mary and I run down James Street, burst through the door of Carpenter's Grocery, kick off our shoes, and yell, "Mom, we're going fishing." "Oh, no, you're not," she says. "Somebody will lose an eye." Well, we did not want to lie to our mother. But we had to, because if we did not go fishing, we were going to die. We had to go fishing. And so we would say, "Yes, Mother, we shall obey you." And then we snuck down into the basement. Now, the basement was where we had the coal bin and the coal furnace. Tons of coal would be there, and it was almost always all gone by the summer. Mary and I would go down into the basement, and there we would make our secret fishing poles. We had stashed willow sticks and string for line and paperclip hooks that we had bent so they were going to catch us some fish. We got balls of Wonder Bread bait and snuck down to the municipal dock, where we spent the entire day reeling in one inedible fish after another. We had sunnies and carp and baby perch. And one day, Mary caught an eel off the end of the dock in the dark, dark green, fetid seaweed water. And then it was on the end of the dock, just kind of flopping around. And Mary said, "Don't touch it, Reg. Don't touch it. It's an electric eel. You're going to get electrified." See, my sister Mary was 4 years older than me, and she knew everything. "Reg, you swallow a cherry pit, cherry tree's going to grow out your ears. If you swallow a watermelon seed, Reg, you are going to have to poop out a watermelon. And let me tell you, it's not going to be a sugar baby either. Dragonflies are sent by the Pope to sew Catholic girls' legs together." She knows everything. At the end of a long fishing day, Mary and I drag our catch home. Mom sees the fish in the pole and says, "Girls, put this sin on your list for confession." Dad smiles approvingly and gets out the cutting board. Now, everybody in my town had a cutting board in their backyard. Pop guts, scales, and then fries the fish in a secret batter that has something to do with beer. Mary loves the tails crunchy like potato chips, so he burns those for her. At night, Mary and I sleep in the same bed. We drift off to sleep after talking about perch and what makes the best bait. Now, when we aren't fishing, Mary and I are swimming at Mercer's Dock. Mercer's Beach, it's a beach, and it's had a lot of docks. But Mercer's Beach is a cove, really, with a gently sloping sandy bottom and no current. And everybody learns to swim there on the Saturday mornings with Mrs. Brabaugh, our gym teacher. Now, I don't want to brag, but I was a great swimmer. I knew this because Mrs. Brabaugh always asked me to demonstrate doing the dead man's float. I'd stand up in my two-piece cobalt blue spandex bathing suit and throw myself into the water, my arms splayed to the side. I imagined that I'd just been thrown from a World War II U-boat, and I was waiting for someone to pick me up when 3, 1,000, 12, 1,000. 51,000. I come to the top, gasping for air, and Mrs. Bravo would say, "Girls, that's how you do the dead man's float properly." We didn't know why she talked like that, because she was from Clayton, too. After swimming lessons, Mary and I hide behind the dunes. They're just these little hills, but we call them the dunes. We hunker down and wait for girls, my sister Cindy's age, to come down. Now, these girls are very mature, maybe 13, 14 years old. And they're wearing polka-dotted, molded, rigid, plastic, styrofoam bikinis with power bows at the hips and breasts. They spread their blankets under the large oak tree and begin to beautify. Globs of emerald green dippity-doo hair sculpting gel turns hair into spiky horns. Slabs of hair are rolled onto extra-large orange juice cans that get stabbed with bobby pins the size of railroad spikes. And then they smear their bodies with skin stain, baby oil, and iodine. Do you remember that? Yeah. Everything gets pinned, slathered, and glued into place. The allure trap is set. Now all they have to do is wait for the boys. Mary and I wait too. See, we know something these girls don't know. The sand at Mercer's Beach is full of sand fleas. And after a while of discreet itching, they lose their cool, jump up, scream like banshees, and rip their skin off. It's very attractive. We jump up too and run down to the water to have an underwater tea party. Have you guys ever been to an exclusive underwater tea party? Oh, it's so much fun. In case you get an invitation, this is the proper etiquette. Jump way up, cross your legs, hold your nose, and sit at the bottom with your eyes open. Then pretend to drink tea at Harrod's with the Queen, pinky fully extended, while holding a scintillated conversation in fish speak. And then we pop to the top and scream, "Hey man, did you hear what I said? I said hello." Well, when we weren't fishing in the river, we were swimming in it. And when we weren't swimming in it, we were wading in it. When we weren't wading in it, we were bathing in it. And when we didn't bathe in it, we were peeing in it. And when we weren't peeing in it, we were drinking from it. Growing up on the St. Lawrence River was a magical experience. The river was like a great mother to us, a great womb in which we all grew. But like most mothers, the river could be changeable and moody. She could be a great mother or a terrible one who asks one of us down to her playground to play for keeps, like the Thompson boy. He was my brother Tim's age, 16, all gangly and pimply. One late afternoon, he took his boat out to do a beer run in Canada. Molson's was exotic, and a storm rolled in. His boat capsized, and he drowned. Our house was near the docks, and when the firefighters fished his boat out that night, they parked it in front of the picture window on our grocery store that read, "Salada Tea." The red safety lights on the back of his boat were still flashing, and all five of us kids and our mother stood at the window. James Street, the main street, is slick and shining from the rain, and the freshly painted white line down the middle is glowing. Mrs. Thompson runs down the middle of the James Street. Her body is silhouetted by the street lights. Her hair is wild, her arms are flailing, and she is crying, "My son, my son." We all clustered together with that horrible combination, sympathy and gratitude. We were so sorry she had lost her boy, and so grateful it wasn't one of us. When the river acts up, the mothers form a brigade against her. Our mothers tell us that we aren't allowed to go down to the river unless one of them is with us. Well, face it, that means we're never going to go because mothers don't have fun. If they look outside and can't see us in the yard, or if we don't answer their call, the tin can telephones drop from the sky and the news spreads from one ear to the next. And all the mothers fan out across the docks and beaches and start calling our name. A song of names rings out in the air over the waves and boats. Mary, Timothy, Cynthia, Susan, Regina. And if we don't come right away, later on we're going to have a burning backside that reminded us we should have. Still, we listen because we are afraid. But not going to the river, that's like not remembering your own name or forgetting how to breathe. You can't do it. So after a while, a good long while, we start to forget. And we make our clandestine fishing poles and we grab some Wonder Bread bait. We sneak down to the river. We fish. We swim. We practice doing the dead man's float. Christ above us. Christ beneath us. Christ beside us. Christ within us. Invisible, we see you. Christ above us. With earthly eyes, we see above us clouds or sunshine, gray or bright. But with the eye of faith, we know you reign, instinct in the sun ray, speaking in the storm, warming and moving all creation. Christ above us. Invisible, we see you, Christ beneath us. With earthly eyes, we see beneath us stones and dust and dross. But with the eyes of faith, we know you uphold. In you, all things consist and hang together. The very atom is light energy. The grass is vibrant. The rocks pulsate. All is in flux. Turn but a stone and an angel moves. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Unknowable, we know you. Christ beneath us. Inapprehensible, we know you. Christ beside us. With earthly eyes, we see men and women exuberant or dull, tall or small. But with the eye of faith, we know you dwell in each. You are imprisoned in the dope fiend and the drunk, dark in the dungeon, but you are there. You are released, resplendent in the loving mother, the passionate bride, and in every sacrificial soul. Inapprehensible, we know you, Christ beside us. Intangible, we touch you, Christ within us. With earthly eyes, we see ourselves, dust of the dust, earth of the earth. But with the eye of faith, we know ourselves all girt about of eternal stuff, our minds capable of divinity, our bodies groaning, waiting for the revealing, our souls redeemed, renewed. Intangible, we touch you, Christ within us. Christ above us, beneath us, beside us, within us. What need have we for temples made with hands? Thank you.